Good morning and welcome to the August 24th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on what looks to be like another beautiful day here in Park City.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone in the Wasatch back.
You know, a couple weeks ago, Kevin, we did a segment on the Paramount antitrust merger lawsuit. And I don't know if you caught that, but in the NPR News, one of the things we talked about during that segment with Patrick Neville was that there were going to be settlement talks, and I, for one, was skeptical as to whether they would go anywhere. Well, what we learned this morning, if you caught, they just mentioned on the news, is that California Attorney General Rob Bonta has scuttled settlement talks, although he remains open, apparently, to re-pursuing them in the future.
Exactly. And what do we have for a show this morning? We have Mark Vance, a local kid. He was a kid back in 1980. He went up to Alaska for 45 years fishing. He wrote a book, The Commercial Fisherman. We recorded him on Friday. Fantastic chat. And we're going to jump right into the right after we're pay some bills. There's a sentence in today's guest's new memoir that I want to read before we get started. Commercial fishing isn't just a job, it's a gamble. Every season you bet months of your life against the weather, the fish, and your own determination. Sometimes you win, sometimes the ocean reminds you who's really in charge. 5 days after graduating from Park City High School in 1980, Mark Vance and his identical twin brother, Malcolm, were shipped north to Alaska by parents who had decided it was time for their unruly sons to go to work. What followed was one of the most extraordinary, unplanned careers in the history of American labor. The book is The Commercial Fisherman, and it follows the twin brothers from wide-eyed teenagers to seasoned captains navigating storms, collapsing markets, brutal weather, mechanical breakdowns, and the relentless gamble of commercial fishing across 45 seasons in Bristol Bay, Alaska. Mark Vance is a former professional skier, Hollywood assistant director, and now a debut author. And best of all, he's our neighbor. He lives right here in Heber. We are lucky to be joined by him this morning. Mark, good morning, and thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Okay, let's cast a line. You were known as a natural storyteller who would come home from Alaska every winter and hold people captive with these stories. What made this the right time to finally write them down, and what's the hardest part of turning 45 seasons of lived experience into a book?
That's probably the biggest part, is just what to write about. There's so many stories and so much to write about. You just kind of got to narrow it down to what you think your audience or people might want to hear, things that even a lot of friends that I have, you know, in Heber and Park City, will, they, when they're reading the book, they said, oh, you already told me about that, but it's in the book now. I have hundreds more stories, but at the time, what would come to my mind, a lot to do with was, you know, I have to give a lot of credit to my daughter, who would always be listening to stories over the years, and she helped me write, oh, what about this one? What about this one? What about this one? And then I would write about them and started really accumulating what was doing it, and she was really instrumental in helping me to narrow it down to what was in there. Yeah, it definitely wasn't just write it, and then there was so many stories I left out, but the ones that made it were just ones that she thought, you know, was helping me out that people would want to hear about.
So the ones you left out were to protect the innocent.
A lot of it, yes. And some, you know, gruesome stories of bar fights and things like that. It's things that I saw that probably shouldn't be repeated.
There you go. So the book has been compared to books by Sebastian Younger, Mark Kurlansky, and John Steinbeck. Those are remarkable comparisons for a new author. What writers or what books shaped how you wanted to tell this story, and how did you find your voice? Was it the same storyteller voice, or with a little bit of your daughter involved?
No, I love those authors. You know, every summer you would read books for boredom when you're out on the boat and on anchor, and books were always just a major part of it. It was whether playing cribbage or reading books is how you pass your time as a fisherman. You're on anchor and waiting for the periods to open, and love those guys, and started realizing I got to tell a story, but also tell about the fishery. And that's what I was really trying to convey, is what the fishery is like and what would you go into it, and what happens to your mind about more fish, and your endless hours of compression of a season of basically 3 weeks of fish that just run for a river, and you got to catch them in that time frame. And the more you catch, the more you make, and the more you make, the more your mind starts going into obsession of, you don't want to stop for fit, you know, stop for anything, mm-hmm. for, let alone food, drinking water, changing sleep. Your clothes,
yeah.
sleep. And the sleep deprivation is what really gets to you. You start realizing, you know, after 30, 35, 40 hours, like, oh my gosh, I'm blurring out without realizing I have to sleep. And all you're thinking is, I got to make the next opener. And you're watching your crew members who are literally practically falling down and begging for food. You throw them a Snickers bar and a Coca-Cola, and they're like, this is not a meal. I need to eat.
And this happens when the fish, when you're in a good space. In other words, this is kind of a happy problem, isn't it? Because it's only happening because you're catching a lot of fish.
Yeah. Well, you're in a moment of, it's so compressioned of making money.
Exactly.
You want your money, and you only have, I mean, X amount. After doing it for 45 years, you get done with the season, and then you start reliving the moments when, you know, what happened. I mean, there's stories of, you know, missing a period because of, you know, certain things, if something breaks, and now you're wrenching, trying to make the opener, and you don't make it, and then you hear of everybody catching 8,000, 10,000, 12,000 pounds, and boom, you just equated to, we just lost $12,000,
$15,000. Yeah, because something broke.
Yeah, and it's always back to, you know, why didn't we check that in preseason? So usually give yourself 2 weeks before the season to just look around, find the gremlins that got in there over the winter, and just start wrenching away at everything, anything, just anything that you won't break down in the middle of the season.
Right. All right, take us back to graduation in 1980. What do you remember about your journey north with your brother Malcolm?
Well, the whole part of being unruly twins, and all we wanted to do was ski, goof off, and, you know, getting suspended for school for things and just not listening. And the parents were just at wit's end. And it was, you know, hey, my grandfather worked in the frozen food business in San Francisco, and him and a bunch of executives came up with a brilliant idea of, let's send these kids north to Alaska. We had no idea where we were going or what we were doing, but we had just agreed, sure, getting away from you guys, getting away from the parents, sure, let's go north.
Well, in the book, you have that one story where your dad said you have to go to class, but there was a ski race, and you guys hit the mountain, and you got back, and all your equipment was...
Well, the ski race was the next day.
Oh, okay.
But it was the day that he came and said, you're going to school, and we... It's basically, it was, what do you mean go to school? It just snowed 3 feet of powder and, you know, light Utah snow up at Park City Mountain Resort. And it was, we're going skiing. And he said, if that's what you want to do, you'll see what happens. And we saw what happened. Yeah. It wasn't a fun dad's son day, put it that way.
Okay, so we sort of, in a sense, we started in the middle. And what I mean by that is, let's take a step back and sort of explain the business of salmon fishing. Bristol Bay is described as this most productive wild salmon fishery on earth. Can you give us a sense of what an opener actually looks like? What does it mean? What do you do? Take us back.
Yeah, to lead into what an opener is. Basically, to back it up to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, they're upriver, literally with little tallywhackers in their hand across a river stream with weirs, which are just basically almost just boards going into the river, and fish are going through, and there's a bridge on top, and there's college students standing on top clicking salmon while they're going through. After so many fish, you know, the announcement comes over the radio, and we're just sitting on pins and needles waiting for the announcement. And they'll pre-give it to you on the radio station up there or over the VHF, is there'll be an announcement at 9 a.m. on Wednesday. So now we're all waiting, and you're here, and all of a sudden it's, This is Alaska Department of Fish and Game with an announcement for the Igigig District. X amount of fish has gone upriver. We'll now be a four-hour opener from 12 noon until 4 p.m. It's usually always about the tides. You work off the tides. So you'll be always 3 hours into the flood. So it starts getting fish up the river so people who are the set netters can get fish up river. So it's 3 hours into the flood and into about an hour, hour and a half into the change of the tide, into the ebb of the tide. Back, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, they used to give us 8 to 10 hour periods, big long periods where they were giving us all of the flood and all of the ebb. And we were just destroying the fish in minutes, you know, or in hours. And then they started making it only like 4 hour windows now, 6 hours max, but then doing it both. So you get one tide a day or two tides a day. And when you start going double tides, that's when you start burning everybody out because stuff breaks.
Okay, so just we're setting the stage now. You have a boat, you have a crew, but in Alaska, you're only allowed to fish in certain times. So all this is about is waiting for the state to say, okay, go. Tell us about when they say, okay, go. How big is the boat? How big is the crew? What kind of equipment are you carrying? How do you catch the fish?
So you have a 32-foot boat. That's regulation. Over the years, they went from, you know, sailboats to wooden boats with engines, and then it went to the fiberglass boats, then the aluminum boats, and the propulsion started changing. Bigger engines, bigger props, bigger thing. So you get with a boat, then you go into, got to get a crew. Many, many years, my brother and I, to save money, it would be just the two of us on the boat. And exhaustion and grit, you know, youth was just keeping us going. But in the overall years, you usually have a deckhand. So you usually have a captain, two deckhands, if not three sometimes on the bigger boats. And then you're regulated with only a certain amount of net. You have 150 fathoms. And you can cut those up into any way you want. You make the three shackles of gear. You could put them down to two, four, six shackles of gear. Basically, it comes down to is when you're destroying gear, how much do you want to cut off and, you know, dump or go get a new peat and go into shore and get a new net? Some guys, you know, they lace it all together and, you know, they'll destroy 150 fathoms and then just go get another one. And it starts becoming expensive. But in the big picture, everybody has, what's that called? You have the same amount of everything. It's like a football team. You all have the same amount of field. You have the same players, the same, everything's there, but certain things are better for certain teams. And that one being is boats. And where the boats have gone into this era is you've gone into jet boats. And the jet boats are absolutely phenomenal. One, they're a lot wider, but they're working they've only got like 6-8 inches of draft. And that's where the fish love to hang out. Is the shallower the draft, the better, because they love rubbing their bellies on the sand, which gets them ready for spawning. And so the jet boats have come in, and they just come, you know, on high speed, lay it out. Like, we'll just sit there with binoculars and looking at 500 yards away, and you're just like, oh, my God, their nets are just boiling with fish. We had always helped. We would be right here 500 yards away hoping the fish come off the shallows into our nets. And it was good for the years our boats, we were all kind of the competitive. But yeah. Once jet boats came into play, it was a whole new ball game. And with age and time, you have to make the decision. Am I going to make literally a $1 million investment in a new jet boat or just get out of the fishery? My brother and I were already tired, you know, with shoulder injuries and carpal tunnel and everything that's just 45 years of fishing. We're just like, you know, I still love the excitement of watching a net boil with fish, but then you look at the workload to get it out of the net and over to the market. So it was like, make $1 million investment or get out. And that was our decision, was we couldn't afford a new boat.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the salmon fishing. but I understand you also did some crabbing up in the Bering Sea.
Yep. That was the guy I first started with salmon fishing was also a crabber. And so he just said, you're going with me out there. And it was, you know, that's a whole nother ball of wax of energy of crab fishing and Bering Sea waves and everything else and getting swept across the deck and waves hitting. And, you know, that's a whole different ball game of strength and being stupid.
Yeah. Now, how did your experience as a salmon fisherman help you do the crabbing? Steady feet on the deck, I assume?
Yeah, that and learning seamanship, knowing your knots in emergencies and, you know, everything to do with staying on the boat, seeing a problem, fix a problem. There's a lot of times on boats, you know, it's like, you don't even talk about that. You just went and fixed something. You just see something wrong. You just fix it because you know you're fixing everybody's lives. I mean, there's a time. So, you know, it's basically just the word. It's fishing. You're just on a bigger boat and bigger crab pots, just bigger things, but it's fishing. So you don't really, you don't really need to be compared to. I mean, if I said, oh, I'm going to go out tuna fishing or I'm going to go do another fishery, and that becomes your professional fisherman. I wanted to ski. So fishing, especially in the summertime, was a perfect correlation to fish all summer into the fall, and then you ski all winter, and then back to skiing or back to fishing in the spring.
If you're just joining us, we're having a wonderful discussion with Mark Vance about his new book, The Commercial Fisherman. Stay with us. This is a wonderful book.
Tell us a little bit about the life off the boat. What was it like to live in this part of Alaska? And what was the community of I assume you were in a community of fishermen, is that right?
Yeah, I lived up in mostly in the wintertime. You know, I was in a lot of fishing communities being a fisherman, but in the winters, it was always ski resorts. And
But in Alaska.
Yeah, but I lived at Alyeska Resort in Alaska, okay, which is a ski resort up in Alaska outside of Anchorage, and worked on the events department and building ski races and things like that. So I was on a race department in Alaska, but being around community, every time we turn around, we're heading down to Homer to go halibut fishing, or we go head over here to go different towns to do so. Tons of fishing communities, but living, you know, around a lot of the fishing communities, there's a lot of great, you know, local fishing bars.
Yeah, in the summertime, as I was reading the book, I somehow had this impression of Deadwood, like this would be a small community, relatively rustic, relatively not very fancy living conditions. Basically, it was buckrooms and bars. This is what it sounded like.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of it. But then again, everybody, the fishermen, buy a land or buy a house and fix it up, and that's where they live. And they're nice. I mean, everybody's spending their money. I mean, there's gorgeous homes all over Alaska of just fishermen who've made a lot of money, but they put this beautiful home in the middle of you, like, wow, okay. This is a you live in a nice house in a really small little town that doesn't really have a lot to it, but that's where they love to live. My brother is one of them. My brother lives in a little town called McCarthy in the Wrangell St. Elias Mountains and has had no water and no electricity for 40 years. And he has built a beautiful home, but he still takes his, in the winter, it's his snowmobile. Summers is his four-wheeler. And he goes down and fills up 5-gallon buckets in the spring water, and he goes and gets 20 to 25 5-gallon buckets of water, takes them home, and it lasts him all week. And that's what he's been doing for 40 years.
How far does he have to travel to get to the spring?
You know, probably not that far, like, eighth of a mile.
Heck, if it's a block, it seems like an awfully long way.
Half mile. Yeah, to me, I'm like, I was just there a couple weeks ago and having fun, and I'm like, God, this is, you're just still on bucket water.
And he chooses to do this. I mean, I take it you couldn't do it well. You couldn't do a solar generator.
He has solar, so he has his power, yes. And so he's, you know, very informed, watches tons of TV, things like that. He's just very busy, has a, like a weird gun turret you know, bigger than this office. So it's probably like 25 by 25 room upstairs. And he does leather work and looks right out at the Wrangell St. Elias Mountains. And it's a great lifestyle. But it's back to, you know, Malcolm, you don't have any running water. And he still has an outhouse.
Oh, my.
40 below zero weather. And he's going outside to go to the bathroom.
Holy cow.
And I was like, and, you know, but he comes out, you know, he loves the world. And he, you know, will come out 2-3 months, weddings, funerals, and a trip to Honduras or other friends. This year he's going to the Zambezi River in Africa to go rafting with like 15 other friends. So he gets out and about. And gets out for the dead of winter, but it's still one of those, when are you going to get water?
Save some of the money. Put in some plumbing. So jumping back to the book, it's been compared to Sebastian Younger's The Perfect Storm, which is, you know, tragic. What was the closest you and Malcolm came to never coming back home?
Yeah, there's so many stories, but... the biggest one I think I even related in the book, which was we were brand new, our very first boat. All we had in there was a compass and a CB radio. And we were just living off of visual. So that night we were at the North Marker and you don't want to go dry. We went dry. The tide went out, full load of fish, and we got stuck. So we throw the anchor out, waiting for the tide to come in. Everything that could have gone wrong that night, and we were just young little puppies that had no idea what to do. And a lot of people on the CB going, hey, you guys all right in there? Before the tide came in, yeah, we're okay. He goes, be careful. I think there's a storm coming tonight. Well, the storm came in and it was like 40 mile an hour winds, which you know kicks the waves up. So as it's coming in over the bar, the waves are just compounding and getting higher and higher. So what happens when the tide's coming in, it lifts the boat up with a wave and slams you right back down on the bottom, and you split the bottom of the boat out, and it just throws the keel up into the boat, which just splits the timbers. And we sat and took a beating for about an hour and a half. And finally we think, you know, we got enough water under us. So we pull the anchor, and with it though, at the same time, the fog came in. And so it's foggy. We don't have any idea where we're at. We have no land mass. It's pitch black, dark night. And we think, so one minute we're like passing the waves thinking, okay, we're heading out into the channel to get into the ship's channel to get home, which is another 2-hour run. But with that, we all of a sudden think, all right, we made it. Well, what happened was, we got turned around with the waves and it pushed us back into shore, which next thing you know, we think we're riding with the waves thinking we're in the channel, and boom, we hit the sand again and we're, you know, screaming, yelling at each other. We're, oh my God, we've hit the beach. We're back at the beach. And we turn around, go back into the waves and work our way back out. And we're slamming and banging for 4 hours. We were exhausted, and literally, I didn't think we were coming back because of there was a lot of damage to the boat.
Yeah.
It was a old wooden boat, and then after 4 hours, we saw lights finally, and we saw the ships, and we delivered, and then the opener was 2 hours later. There was another opener, and we made it to the next opener, but that's one of, you know, 20 times that, you know, we didn't think we were coming back, and it's the screaming, the yelling, and, you know, one time we had our windows blow out because we were in the surf and went through the wave, and it just smashed right through the windows. So, and that took out all the electronics, and, you know, all the mess that happens with that kind of stuff. So I loved Sebastian Younger's book, The Perfect Storm, because you realize how bad it can get out there. And for me, crab fishing, it was, the perfect storm was 100 mile an hour winds with 100 foot seas. And for me, my biggest storm was 50 foot seas with 100 mile an hour winds. And it was horrific for trying to just battle that and get through that. And that's like one of those, all you're doing is taking your wheel watch. So every 2 hours, somebody had to be on wheel watch. And you sat with that storm in a big boat. I think it was on a 120-foot boat, 130-foot boat. And what you do is you throttle up, going up the face of the wave. And when you get to the top of the wave, you pull back the throttle so you slowly go over the top of the wave. And then you hit the gas again and or the fuel and go right back up to the next, go through the trough and up to the top of the next one. And for hours, you're exhausted while everybody else is trying to
just sleep.
Sleep, but you're not sleeping. You literally have your survival suit out and ready to hang out and ready to go.
Now, I gotta imagine the engines are pretty strong in that boat to go vertical.
On a crab boat?
Yeah.
Oh, they're huge. Yeah. You got almost propellers the size of this room. 10 foot, like 10 foot by 10 foot propellers. They're big on big boats. And you're in control. And that's the part is that if you get sideways, that's where you're
screwed.
And the other part is why you pull back on the throttle when you get to the top. Mm-hmm. Because when you hit the crest of the wave, your stern end of the boat, the propeller comes out of the water. And you can't have no water resistance. The shaft of the prop will then over speed with no resistance. So then you could have the possibility of breaking the coupling on the transmission.
Or killing the bearings in the engine.
All that.
Yeah.
Burn them out quickly. So yeah, it's a crazy little world of being at sea. And that's the part of you learn just survival as well as when you come home, and I've laughed at so many of my relationships, when they get so worried something broke, and you're like, yeah, whatever, it's fixable. Everything's fixable.
Everything when breaks and everything's fixable.
As a fisherman, everything breaks and everything's fixable, and there's no job too big. I mean, you're practically pulling an engine out. It's almost like a NASCAR. Pull it out, put it back in 12 hours. Hmm. And it's just always, everything's fixable. So at home, you know, they're like, oh my God, this is like broken. I'm like, no big deal. You just pull it out, put a new one in. Yeah. Jesus.
Fix it.
Charlie. Fix it.
So the book traces the evolution of the Alaskan fishing industry from your cannery bunkhouses at the beginning and hand-stacked fish to modern refrigeration systems, permit economics, and volatile global seafood markets. What was the single biggest economic shift you witnessed during those four decades, and how did that change the business of fishing?
Yeah, the highs and lows. One is, you know, there's big seasons, low seasons, and they do cycle. You always watch this 10-year cycle of up and then down. That's just the fish coming to the rivers. And then it's the economic part of the money. And one of the biggest changes in the industry was called cash buyers. And cash buyers were Japanese and Chinese freighters that were processing ships. And they were coming in and offering cash for our fish. While our domestic buyers, our main canneries, were, you know, trying to pay the price of because of what the cash buyers were paying. And our canneries were going broke. Hmm. So they're creating independent fishermen that we didn't mind living offshore, go and get two Connexes, fill it with all your gear, and in the winter, park your boat in between them and buying land and putting them as that, and people living in the Connexes and preseason, getting ready, and then going out, and they were just cash buyer guys. And they were making a lot of money. We were talking $1.50 to $2.50 a pound, while our canneries could only afford 75, 80 cents a pound because of all the logistics and what they were trying to, you know, pay for to get their salmon to the market in the United States. So all the canneries got together and formed a legislative act, and I forgot what it was called, but they took away all foreign interest in our fish and said we could handle all this salmon and all this fish and process it and get it to the market. And yes, we then will sell it to the foreign markets. And the legislators and everybody agreed, and they turned our turned our whole fishery into then they had full control. Our canneries had full control of the price. And the price then went to crazy 40 cents a pound.
Oh.
And that became where, you know, then it was 40 cents, 60 cents. And we had, in the book, it's talking about the strikes. And we were striking to get better wages. And we couldn't get those cash buyers back. And we still can't. We still live to this day. And then when the canneries can't handle all of our fish and they're just backed up with boats full of fish and refrigerated fish to bring in, they put us on limit. So we'll be in the peak of the season, just fish just coming over the gunnels, just like making money, and they'll put us on a limit of 3,000 pounds per tide, or 5,000 pounds, whatever they think they can handle. They'll just take, you know, take their fleet number and then times it by 3,000 to 5,000, and we'll be put on limits in the peak of the season. And it's been a gut-wrenching punch for the last 20 years with being on, you know, every year we've been put on limits.
And while you're stacked up in your boat waiting to offload, you're going to miss an opener.
Absolutely. Yeah, all kinds of things happen. Even then, though, the cannery can even tell you, we've stopped buying. We have to process so much fish. And then the companies that are still able to fish, you know, we're not out there. Our fleet is not out. And, you know, that other fleet is out there just slamming fish. So it's a very interesting, you know, the dynamics of the correlation between the canneries and the fishermen.
And the legislature.
And legislature now, too. I've written letters. I've gotten involved to start, you know, learning. I've been, you know, over the years, learning how to write letters to your Congress and to senators and trying to, like, you've got to take this, you know, thing, let foreign interest back in to buy our fish. The strikes are an interesting thing because we strike for a better price. Like, okay, we're not going to catch fish for you. You need to raise your price, so you're going to get no fish. Well, now all the fish are rushing into the river, and it's over-escapement. And so now you have over-escapement issues where fish are on top of each other. And there's been, where the big one of Solidarity of 90, was it 90 or 92? There was so much fish up river that they were just compounding on top of each other that they had to get in there and dynamite the fish so that more fish could get up river, like clear the alley. It was a crazy, like, we're like, oh my gosh, this is just crazy talk. What's going on?
If you're just tuning in, we're having a great discussion with Mark Vance about his book, The Commercial Fisherman. If you're staying with us, thanks for listening in. Let's get back to it. So commercial fishing permits are a significant financial asset in Alaska. How do you think about the economics of the fishery as a business? And what did 45 seasons teach you about managing risk in an industry governed by weather, legislative regulation, and global commodity markets?
For personal finances?
Yeah.
You know, that's a thing about fishermen is we're probably not the smartest with money. And you pre-think, you know, what you're going to need for the boat for the next year. By the end of the season, there's stuff that you've cobbled together and duct tape and baling wire and just trying to keep it going. And you know you have to buy new parts for the next season. So when you first get off the boat, you start ordering parts for the next season and just have them come in and just stockpile them to send them north for the next spring. But, you know, we're fishermen and we love to just spend the money you make because there isn't a feeling of what if tomorrow is my last day? What if the boat sinks? So you're always living lifestyle like there is no tomorrow. You're living like you're never going to make it. And as a thing for fishermen is buying a piece of gold jewelry so you can buy a plane ticket back up, hawk it. So you always, for years, I would buy a gold nugget and wear it around my neck. And it was always that thing that by springtime, I was at a pawn shop giving my gold, selling my chunk of an ounce of gold for whatever it was those days, and buying another plane ticket to get back to Alaska. And that's always been a thing of any fisherman. You live like there's no tomorrow. You're a pirate. That's like how pirates live. You just, there's always no tomorrow. Just keep spending it because you're going to have another year the next year.
You paint a picture of a high-risk lifestyle where you know there may be no tomorrow. This sort of makes me wonder, many of us have watched Deadliest Catch, right? And it sort of turns commercial fishing into a bit of a television phenomenon. The classic question we have is, how accurate was that show?
Very. Yeah, I watch it. Obviously, I know all those guys. After the 10 years of crabbing I was doing through the 80s into the 90s, and I got out, and I know a lot of those guys on the show really well, and I watch it, and it is what it is. You're fishing, and there's waves, and you're working in there. And I always had that funny thing when it first came out. I was like, who would want to watch me work? I was always like, wow, how would somebody want to watch me run around on deck catching crab and fishing and everything? But it became a, you know, it's a great hit. And predicts it as it's a great situation of it is real. You can't not have the ocean do what the ocean does.
Yeah.
And people fall overboard and, you know, things happen out there. Things break. It is what it is. Hydraulics snap and you're dead in the water. You know, you can't fish without it. So Deadly Sketch is a great show with it. There was a show called Battle on the Bay, which was going to be fishing in Bristol Bay. And I talked to the producers and I got ourselves on the show. But once I told my brother hates cameras, hates notoriety. Even to probably come here to talk on a microphone, he would just drive him bananas because he doesn't like that kind of attention.
Yeah.
But we were on Battle on the Bay and we were six boats and they'll be like, you know, well, what are the Vance brothers doing over here in Igigig? And what are we doing over here in this? You know, there would be like that competition. And my brother heard that I was bringing a camera crew on our boat and he went ballistic and basically said, I'm not fishing. I'm not fishing. You bring a camera crew. And I'm like, Malcolm, you have to be on the show. You have to be with me. I sold us as twin brothers on a boat. You've got to be here with us. And he's like, no, no, no. And I had to go call the producers and told them, my brother doesn't want to be on the show and I'm sorry. They were all pissy. So if you do look up Battle on the Bay, there's only five boats on the show. Number six got out. So
yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no, I watched there's so much you can't really fake certain things about fishing.
Yeah.
You know, people get hurt. I mean, it is what it is.
How many crew members are on, show crew members are on the crab boat?
Usually about five, sometimes six.
There's room for them?
Yeah, yeah. Crab boats are big. I mean, they're 120, 130 footers.
But they have to get more food.
Oh, yeah.
They have to stock more food and water.
Yeah. Even back when I was out with a crab story, we were running out of water. We couldn't find them. Finally, we found them, and we had to keep going. But we were running out of water, so nobody got to shower for, like, 8 days, and it was stinky, and it was just a long, food was running out. We were down to, you know, just muffins.
And you're burning the calories.
Yeah, burning calories, and no more meat. We were running out of everything, but you make it through it because you got to fill the boat. It's just what you just go through just to be a fisherman.
Yeah, so one of the captains on the show, Keith Colburn, who also wrote a foreword for your book, so you knew him as when you guys were kids in Tahoe.
Yeah, grew up with him. We were elementary school and up into high school, and just knew him as we were kids. And yeah, he was a great friend. And as I was coming home with all this money and telling stories, or yeah, I guess my storytelling was people were listening. Just said, hey, how do I get up there? And so I got him his first job on a fishing boat with Ole Oxvold. And Keith took right to it, and then it was another year, and then he wanted to go crab fishing. He went out crabbing, and use the word, the rest is history. Keith just went on to become on Deadliest Catch and who he is these days. And it's always fun to see him and talk it up about the business.
So you paint a picture of this kind of wild, unpredictable career on the fishing side. And yet, during the summers, you become an assistant director in Hollywood. I'm trying to put those two pieces together. How'd that happen?
It was just, I was up in Alaska, live at Alyeska Resort, Girdwood, in Alaska, and had a really bad fishing season, had a really bad crab season. That's when I was already up there. Bad crab, bad salmon fishing, really bad salmon fishing season where we only made our plane tickets home.
Wow.
And I needed a job, and it was late October before ski season was coming in, and there was just, I had nothing going on. And a friend just said, hey, do you want to work on a commercial? And it was a big Army commercial. And I was like, yeah, what do I got to do? So I was going to be a PA, a production assistant. And I couldn't help myself but run around, hey, your coffee's empty. Go and grab a coffee, emptying garbage cans, just staying busy. And they just said, God, you're like the hardest working guy around here. They're like, slow down. And I'm like, I am slowed down. I'm slowed down. All I'm doing is every time I turn around, there's craft service and, there's just a meal every 6 hours. I was like, wow, this is like great business. This is a really fun business. And then they said, hey, we don't want to fly someone up from LA, a second assistant director. Do you want to be our second AD? And I went, yeah, what do I got to do? And to them, they're snickering because they're going to I went from $125 a day to $300 a day when they were supposed to pay a second AD like $400, $500 a day. So they thought they were saving money. And I was like, great. So as it went, we were doing an Army commercial up there in Alaska. And with all my heli skiing experience and being a heli skier in Alaska, they said, hey, nobody wants to go up in the, could you, with being the second AD, go up in the Black Hawk helicopter and talk on the radio to us when talk to the pilot, when to come in and drop the guys and everything. And we'll roll camera and everything. And I'm like, yeah, uh-huh. A Black Hawk helicopter? Yeah. And so I'm in there. We do the job. Everything's, that day, just to finish up that day, all the men are on the ground and the pilot says, heading back to Elmendorf Air Force Base. And I said, let's see what this thing does. And the guy goes, you want a ride? And I go, yeah. Whoa, we're buzzing mountains. We're going practically halfway upside down, coming down. He's giving me a joyride of my lifetime. And that's when I really would get down and all I could say was, I found my next business. I'm going to be in this business for a long time. So it's been 25, 30 years now. Worked my way up now to first assistant director, and I love it. It's just a very, in my intensity, probably of being a fisherman and catching fish, all I think about is get the shot. And, so I get called in on a lot of situations, call it weather. And so it's, if it's the dirtier the weather, the worse the conditions, the more I work is what it is. So I get called in on anything to do with snow jobs, desert jobs, tons of just worse conditions. But a lot of people are like, you won't catch me out there working on that. And to me, I'm like, wow, this is really cool, catching all this really cool things and places to see.
Yeah. So there's different kind of captains. Are you a yeller?
I didn't think I was, but as I wrote the book, I realized that I did turn into that. You morph into somebody you just don't even understand. And that's what the part of, over the years, I always thought I was a really nice, great guy, skier, all these fun things. And then all of a sudden I get up there and the obsession starts just taking you over of doing it. And it starts becoming yelling. There's a lot of engine noise and there's a lot of, snappy back talk from the deckhands. And so you really start getting yourself, yelling and screaming. And I just was working with the magazine, the National Fisherman, and I sent a book out to them to do a review for me. And he said, I've been a fisherman for, 20 years also, and I really enjoyed your book. You're a screamer, aren't you? And that's what, even now you asking me that, I've had to realize that I turned into one of those guys that I probably never wanted to be.
So Mark, earlier in the interview, you talked about how economics had basically caused, and time had caused you to leave. But as we're sitting here today, I'm watching you talk about fishing with clear love in your eyes. You loved doing that. Do you miss it?
I do. Yeah. I miss it extensively. It's back to, I miss the high of the hunt for where the balls of fish are. Could they be sitting on the backside of a sandbar? Could they be coming over the line? You know, where are you going to intercept the fish? And that's the high of the hunt, but I don't like the workload that comes after it. Picking the fish out of the net, the delivery, then you have to scrub the boat. It's just endless hours of work. I mean, one of the biggest things I miss is the camaraderie. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had nationalities, you know, the Frenchmen, the Italians, you know, they all, you know, the Frenchmen, Italians are from Monterey. They were, you know, squid and anchovy fishermen from Monterey. You've got the, you know, actual Norwegians coming over from Norway, and you had, you know, all the fishermen from Seattle, and it was, and then all the locals from the town I'd see every year. And that's one of the biggest things I miss is the camaraderie of the fishery and everybody helping each other. And, you know, like the old adage of, you know, you pop a hood in your driveway, you're going to have four neighbors come over. What's going on over there? This is like everybody was helping each other with the, if something goes wrong, everybody's right there to help.
You are obviously an adrenaline junkie, admittedly. I mean, big mountain skiing, heli skiing. I mean, it's fun stuff.
Yeah, my brother and I had a bungee jumping company for 10 years in Alaska, and adrenaline is just part of it. And
yeah.
I think, you know, commercial fishing is adrenaline. From, you know, being at sea to catching the fish to, you know, getting stuck on sandbars. And, you know, another one of those things of when you're saying almost dying is, you take the tow rope, the tow line to the net is up on the mast so that you can pivot the boat around underneath it. Well, we hit the sandbar and the net kept going down the channel, which is all that weight and fish. And it just took our boat and just laid it over to where water was coming in. And we finally, after so much yelling and talking and all, we finally just cut the line.
Yeah.
We cut the line. The boat came upright. With all the water that was in there, we had to hit the bilge pumps and pump it all out. But our net just took off. And we ended up waiting for enough water so we could float. And then we had to go chase down our net with the screams from 20 other boats of like, "Ah, you can't let your that damn net go by itself." Everybody's screaming because our net would hook up with their net. Fish would then double gill, which then our net stuck to their net.
Yeah.
It was just hell, just another few hours of hell.
So what is what's next for Mark Vance?
Just enjoying life, I guess. I mean, I'm just AD my life away now. I'm getting old enough to wear that word, retirement. I've got a house in Baja, Mexico, and skiing. I've been at Jordanelle the last 5 days every morning, wakeboarding in the mornings. And it's just that workload that I don't want to do. My back is out. My arms are giving out. I have to just say at this age, it's just time to start thinking how much longer you got in life. And as the saying goes, I've never met a man in his deathbed that said, "I wish I would have worked harder."
Yeah, there you go. Well, we just spent a little bit of time with Mark Vance, author of The Commercial Fisherman. Mark, thank you very much for coming up and joining us this morning.
Well, I hope everybody out there support a fisherman and eat wild-caught fish.